I suggest we...
I do hear what you said.
Resume our meeting.
Late reaction. That's funny.
Then we're going to talk about primary financial statements, and I give the floor to Michelle Fisher.
Thank you. At the last ASAF meeting in March, we provided ASAF members with an update on the board's tentative decision regarding the scope of the project, and that was to focus on targeted improvements to the statement of financial performance and the statement of cash flows. We also presented a high-level overview of some of the approaches that we might consider for making those targeted improvements. Now at this meeting, we're bringing more in-depth proposals for some of those targeted improvements. There are five main agenda papers for the meetings, other than the two cover papers, and these papers are all presented to the board at the June board meeting. There are two papers on introducing an EBIT subtotal, one paper on a management performance measure subtotal, one paper on an adjusted earnings per share, and one paper about presentation of the share of associates and joint ventures. Now, during our research and outreach, we heard opposing views about the need for comparability versus the need for flexibility. On one hand, we heard the investors and analysts tell us that the lack of comparability negatively affects the usefulness of IFRS information. However, some preparers tell us it's also important to allow them flexibility to present their view of performance. And so the reason for us bringing all these papers to you today is to show our package of proposals for addressing those conflicting concerns for comparability and flexibility. So, for example, the two papers on EBIT and the paper on the share on associates, they're discussing reducing presentation options and bringing in a comparable EBIT subtotal, whereas papers 21C and D are discussing ways of enhancing the guidance about the use of management performance measures. And these are intended to give more flexibility to preparers. Now, at the June board meeting, we tried discussing these papers in turn. And we
I like the use of the word tried.
We found the meeting slightly disjointed. So I suggest that we discuss the overall package of proposals together today and see how we go. It's a bit difficult to give an update on the board's discussion.
Michelle, there's only so far that you can go. You faithfully representing our...
I think you're probably being quite faithful.
Well, I think the board is quite supportive of the general direction we're going in.
Except it has no idea what this general direction is.
However, they and they're relatively supportive of a principles-based approach, I think, to determining capital structure. However, the board suggested a number of things that we need to take away and think about. I'll give some examples of the main ones. There were some concerns that cash and cash equivalents might be too restrictive as a proxy for temporary investments of excess cash, since temporary investments could include longer-term investments. There was also some concern that we may be putting too much below EBIT. There may be too much classified as finance income and expense in the staff proposal. And this could be quite a big change for some companies, for example, the interest on assets outside capital structure, and that this might have some unintended consequences. For example, one we would discuss was that this might require the interest on financial assets measured at fair value to be both separated and measured at the effective interest rate, which is currently not a requirement. And some board members also thought that having an investing category either before or after EBIT may help to address some of those concerns. I got the sense that the board may be slightly less supportive of the management performance measure, but still have some support. Some example of the comments made, that there were some concerns that we might be elevating the management performance measure to an IFRS measure in the statement of financial performance, which may mean that this measure is no longer subject to the requirements for non-GAAP measures. There were also some concerns about allowing too much flexibility in that measure, but there were also concerns about being too restrictive. For example, if we put too much below EBIT, then there are restrictions, well, the same restrictions on what goes below EBIT would be restrictions on the management performance measure, which could mean that the management performance measure isn't really giving management's view of performance. Some board members supported having the management performance measure as a subtotal, but others suggested we may want to consider having it in a separate reconciliation. If it was in a separate reconciliation, it would then not be restricted to the amounts that are included in EBIT as well. The board didn't discuss the paper on the adjusted earnings per share because it was felt that we needed to address the issues with the management performance measure first. The board briefly discussed the paper on presenting the share of profit or loss of associates and joint ventures. I think there was generally more support for having the share of associates and joint ventures above EBIT rather than below EBIT, with it not being interest or tax. And if we considered an investing category, it may well be placed there. There was also some support for having the location depending on whether the investment is integral to an entity's operations. But noted that there will be significant challenges in us developing requirements over what's considered to be integral. So given the difficulties we had in taking decisions at the board meeting, any feedback we have from you today would be very helpful to us in developing our proposals for when we bring them back to the board. So I'll open it up to the discussion.
Linda.
Thank you. I think it's a presumption on your part that our feedback will be helpful or anything different than what you got from the board. So we've had some discussions with our advisory groups and in particular with our user advisory committee. So I'll just kind of reflect some of the feedback we got from those discussions. So the majority of our user advisory committee was supportive of the ISB coming up with an EBIT subtotal, but indicated that it needs to be clearly defined. And so some of them went all the way to the I, their focus is on the I, okay? And so some of them went all the way to I being only what they would call cash interest, what they would define as cash interest. Others had more appreciation for it. So one of the topics that came up was the leasing standard. And while they're suffering from not fully understanding the implications of the leasing standard just yet, that came up as an example where should that interest cost be included in the I or not. And the other one that came up was pensions. So the interest that you would have imputed from a pension obligation, some of them considered that completely operating and others considered it completely financing, and there was a whole bunch of stuff in the middle. So good luck, okay? So the other thing, that's what I'm saying. Don't. I'm trying to keep your expectations low, okay? The other thing they talked about was, in fact, if you're going to define EBIT, they'd rather see EBITDA because they tend to use that more often. But they said then they want a disaggregation of what you're really including in depreciation and amortization. So it seemed like the depreciation and amortization in that part of the discussion was taking on the same kind of discussion as the interest in the EBIT discussion. So the guy who summed up best said, defining the I to suit views of all users will likely be a challenge. So there you go. But it came to the management performance measure. Surprisingly, our committee members were generally not supportive of that, which I thought they would be. They're basically concerned with how different entities might define it, therefore that's not going to be comparable. Very concerned with the notion of non-recurring or irregular items only being brought out if they were debits as opposed to credits. And when we discussed it further, they said, well, maybe that might work if you gave enough trend, if you required enough trending information to allow them to get a bead on it. But the trending information they wanted was what are the specific adjustments that might be included to get to that operating measure compared to, you know, net income or income before interest and taxes, or whatever measurement you were looking at. So they were very concerned about that. And, you know, the skepticism that, no, whatever measurement Manage defines, they'll simply find the measure that puts them in the most favorable light. So they were concerned with that. And we have two securities regulators who observe that group, the User Advisory Committee. And in that particular meeting, they forgot that they were observers, and they got very involved in the discussion, which was fine. So they were very concerned that the management performance measure would, in essence, be a non-GAAP measure that's in the financial statements. And that caused them some pause. So they basically said they would encourage the ISB to engage with regulators on this particular topic, given the regulatory advice or the regulatory requirements that exist around non-GAAP measures, et cetera. The other thing that some people were interested in, though, is to have a management performance measure, it would be interesting to have management articulate whether or not that measure had an impact on management compensation. So, in effect, if they're defining a measure that they're going to publish, does that then affect the overall management compensation? Is it a trigger for bonuses? Is it a trigger for anything else? We actually did get to the adjusted EPS paper, and in essence, most UAC members were also not supportive of this guidance. What they would rather do is figure it out themselves. So that's our job, to make adjustments to EPS, not anybody else's. So I was a bit surprised by that reaction. And lastly, they did support the notion of putting the share of results from associates and JVs in one spot. Surprisingly, when we transitioned to IFRS, that was a big debate on where that particular item should go. So they would be supportive of seeing it in one location, because it's in potentially different locations and different statements today. So there you go.
Kim.
Thanks, Harry. So we haven't had a chance to discuss this, so these are, you know, mainly my comments. Supportive of an EBIT figure, but I think, just as Linda was commenting on, I think the I is going to really be tricky. Linda mentioned a couple of the things. The other things would be, in IFRS 15, if you've got a significant financing component, again, they're also, you know, going to be interest. So is there going to be consistency throughout wherever some form of discounting for the time value of money, effectively that is going to be interest, and that's going to be sitting in I? I think at the moment, and I don't know if I'm based on the outreach or information that you've got, I think that there's possibly diversity regarding the treatment of foreign exchange gains and losses. And I mean, I'm aware of entities putting those in currently in as financing costs, and so therefore, are they going to form part of the I? I think even fair value gains and losses on derivatives and things like that, I think a lot of non-financial institutions tend to put those in interest as well. So I think those also need to be addressed. And then, you know, is it only going to be interest on, as you're saying, the temporary investment of cash? But then what about longer-term investments that are interest-bearing? And then again, why are we differentiating between interest-bearing instruments and non-interest-bearing instruments? So whether or not that does mean there needs to be some form of an investing category, or is the I meant to be capturing, you know, all investing as well, as opposed to trading? So trading would be sitting, you know, above that line as such. So I do think that, you know, work and focus needs to be placed on the I. On the management measure of performance, I think initially it was, okay, well, that would really be useful. But I suppose some of the concerns I have is in making it now quite prescriptive. So, for example, one of the things is that, you know, well, management can't exclude items which they regard as being outside of their control. Well, again, if it is management's measure of performance, then to what extent is it appropriate or is it reasonable to now say, well, you can't exclude these certain items, because then it's going to go back to, well, then this item called management's measure of performance actually isn't management's measure of performance. And then, so I'm not quite sure at the end of the day whether or not it's going to work having a measure described as management's measure of performance, but then it can't really reflect what management believe the performance is. So again, as you mentioned, if it is going to be, for example, depending upon where you put the share of profit or loss on profits on associates and joint ventures, you know, if management see that as being integral, but now they can't put it there. So again, I don't know what that line item is going to be. And then, of course, at the moment the condition is that if management disclose a measure of performance elsewhere in the annual report that conflicts with this, well, then they can't have this line item, you know, in the financial statements. Again, I don't really know how all that is working and is really providing a, you know, management's view. It's almost a case of if management's view is pretty much the same as the IFRS number, well, then that can be in the income statement, and if it isn't, well, then it can't be. So I don't know if we are, therefore, meeting that objective of management being able to reflect their measure of performance. I mean, on the side of saying, well, is it going to be a non-GAAP measure, you know, arguably, if it is so restrictive and it's got to meet all these requirements, well, it actually potentially ends up by being an IFRS measure, because, you know, there are not too many things which are non-IFRS that they're able to do. So I guess I do have some concerns around those. And then on the location, I certainly think that it should be above the line and not below the tax line. You know, to me, it then looks like it's an item all on its own. So then you start to say, well, you know, and I know there is the debate around, well, what is this share of profit or loss? Is it meant to be a proxy for the change in value of your investment, or is it a one-line consolidation? But, you know, that's for another time. But if you have got other investments that you have less than significant influence in, well, where are those gains and losses sitting? And again, arguably, they're also outside of your control. So I don't really see the basis for putting the share of associates profit or loss below the line. I certainly think it needs to be above the line. And then I was thinking in terms of identifying whether or not it's, you know, integral or not. Well, perhaps management could provide some disclosures around that. And I thought, well, that might come out if it is above the line, and if management are able to present it sort of where they wish to above the line, that might give some insight as to if they do see it as, you know, just being a passive investment, or if it is integral to their operations.
Jim?
Some similar comments. One, it wasn't clear when I looked at defining the capital structure how you would identify assets and liabilities arising from financing, particularly the asset side. If leases are liabilities arising from financing transactions, then are leasing assets that arise from financing transactions? And if not, why not? I don't think that was what was intended, but just wonder, if you think the liabilities arise from financing, then why don't the assets? Similar questions with respect to derivatives. Are derivatives, when they're in an asset position, are they assets that arise from financing? You know, I think it talks about hedging financing activities, but what about a derivative that happens to be an economic hedge but not an accounting hedge? How would I account for that, whether or not it's economically hedging a financing item? Take a derivative that hedges a non-financing item, but it has an excluded component that is interest. So I think, you know, derivatives allows for excluded components. Would that be a financing component or not? So I think a lot of questions in the detail when you start thinking about what assets and liabilities. Given that, I wonder if the title EBIT would just be misleading on its face. I don't think we're talking about all interest, nor do I think we're talking about only interest. Later in the paper, it talks about other FX changes, total fair value changes of financing assets and liabilities, so that's certainly not interest. I think the title on its face could be misleading. So figuring out what this title is, and then even the term taxes, I think, is misleading because we don't mean taxes. I think you mean income taxes, but a tax generated off of revenue might have similar characteristics, but it doesn't fall in the line that we call taxes today. So being very clear about this is not taxes. It's only those things that meet the accounting characteristics of an income tax, so that investors aren't misled by whatever this label that they think they're getting is. It doesn't have a common definition today, but if you're going to start with one, I wouldn't start with, it doesn't look like we're actually trying to identify EBIT. It's some subset of certain financing costs, in certain cases interest. Similar to Linda's question, didn't know if you're going to strip out interest, what you would do, for example, in a zero coupon. Is it cash interest? Is it, you know, economic interest? What if it's at a purchase discount? So again, operationally, several questions there. Also didn't know what you might do with capitalized interest. So I think capitalized interest into inventory would go through cost of goods sold. So you have interest up above. Would you then have to change the standard and say, well, we no longer capitalize interest into inventory because it needs to be separately presented below? Because that could be interest on, of course, long-term obligations that's getting put other places in the geography. And then is it related to the management performance measures? Similar questions as well. And I also wondered if some of the decisions on EBIT and or depending where you go on affiliates might actually contradict the management measure. Certainly, at least in the U.S., we see some companies that include in an operating measure that management uses interest. For example, a defense contractor may pass interest directly on to the government, and so they might view that more as management's view of operations. Similar changes in pension liabilities in some cases are actually contractually billable, and your revenue directly reflects that change. And so management would say, well, in my performance, I actually view that interest as being part of my operations. It's a direct pass-through. Seeing companies in the U.S. also, as it relates to affiliates, view that as, you know, take a pharma company where they're distributing, you know, a product around the world through JVs, viewing that as part of management performance, and might actually view that as a management measure. So how you would then either recycle that income to have it both in a management measure, but then somewhere else in the performance statement. So there's a number of operational questions that seem like they'd need to be worked through. Okay.
Andreas?
Thanks. I think the EBIT question probably can be dealt with easily if you just relabel it earnings before income taxes. So that works, right? I think for the reason that you outlined, some eyes should be above the line, some below, some associates should be above, some should be below. I must say, I'm very skeptical, and these are my personal remarks because we haven't had the time yet to discuss it in our committee. I think we all agree that EBIT is useful. We all agree that we want the principle. The problem is we can't agree on the principle and we can't agree on what EBIT is. So for that reason, I always like it to defining true north. Yet we don't know how to define it. And I think the key that I see is probably to go via more disaggregation and leave it to the analyst where they want to go. Because unless you say, I just want to define a starting point for further analyses that I could see. So if you don't want to force analysts to start with P&L and then work your way backwards somewhere up the ladder, but give them a different starting point, that's fine. But then don't attach any meaning to it, because I think the meaning will be different from analyst to analyst for very good reasons. But I must say, I burnt my fingers on the debt equity split, as I said recently in EFRAC, seeing people backing up things, taking out certain issues, and I would expect the same to happen in an income statement where we define a line, and the more robust we define it, the more people tend to circumvent it. So I'm very skeptical that will work.
Please, Andrew.
Thanks, Hans. We've discussed these papers and the predecessor papers in a number of different forums. I'll try and sort of synthesise the feedback so far. So I think overall there is certainly strong acknowledgement that however we define or specify principles for additional line items, it's not going to suit everybody. So I very much endorse what Andreas said about giving sufficient transparency about the individual line items so people know what's in and know what's out and can make adjustments if that's what they want to do, or indeed if that's what their job is to do. That said, I think that there is broad support for continuing to investigate a principle-based definition of EBIT, but all of the challenges around how that would play out in terms of what would be in and out of both the I and indeed the T came up in our point. Danish shipping taxes, if you want another example. That's something you might think of as economically similar to an income tax, but isn't in the same line item. So apart from the I and the T, it's all perfectly clear. We're okay with the B. Okay, so the link to the capital structure, I think, is interesting. I think if you look at the those capital structure disclosures, I think it's something like paragraph 134 to 135 of IAS 1, and see how those are actually done outside of the banking and insurance sectors, which are kind of out of the scope of this discussion. I think that might give some insight into how this might play out in practice. I won't say what kind of insight those disclosures might actually indicate, but I think if you haven't already, it's worth just taking a look on how companies are currently thinking about defining their capital structure. But the questions around what should be in and what should be above and below the line, I think the examples have all been mentioned before. A bit more scepticism about the proposed approach to a management performance measure. One set of comments I'd summarise as saying we thought the role of the management commentary was to explain the financial statements, not the role of the financial statements to explain the management commentary, which is kind of the direction this seems to be heading in. And so we fully agree that probably for the board to try and define operating profit might be something that belongs in the too difficult pile. So that's going to be very challenging. But the terminology about a management-defined constraint. You know, when I first read that, I thought that's a clear oxymoron, a management-defined constraint. Maybe it's just unfortunate labelling. I think what you're actually trying to do is establish some board-defined principles to add clarity and discipline and consistency around the use of an additional line item, really building upon the existing principles added to IAS 1 in 2014. We tend, I guess, many people I'm hearing are saying that's the way to go. Elaborate those principles to achieve greater discipline, rather than trying to sort of import something from the front part of the annual report and then add some additional restrictions to it, so it might not be quite the same number as in the front part of the annual report. So we'd suggest that's more the way to look at things. But I think actually the underlying ideas in the paper are directionally consistent with that approach. Alternative EPS is kind of, I think it follows on from the management performance measure. We didn't spend too much separate time discussing that. And finally, on shared results of associates and joint ventures, I think there was some appetite to carry on looking at whether there's a principle-based way to identify the integral part of that or the operational part of that and the more investing part of that. I can't offer any particular suggestions on how to articulate that split, but I think that's the sort of preferred route at this stage.
Kimberly?
I think that's certainly echo quite a few of Andrew's comments around EBIT in particular. I think it is worth continuing to explore that and focusing on a principle-based approach to it. I think a lot of the comments around the table have demonstrated why we can't go a rules-based approach, because you won't be able to prescribe how to deal with all the different possibilities, but then it comes back to being very clear, I guess, about what the principle is that you're trying to get to. And I think some of the ideas here around focusing on borrowings and capital structure, because obviously the objective of EBIT is to try and present earnings independent of the entity's capital structure. So it is getting back to those borrowings where they've know, they've taken out debt rather than equity. And that then helps, I think, determine where things go. Like, I would think if you make long-term provisions or employee benefit provisions, yes, there's a financing element to them because, you know, you're getting the employee benefits now and you're paying for them later, but you actually have to do that. You can't provide a retirement benefit when the person's still working. So, and similarly, you can't rehabilitate an asset until you've actually finished using it. So there is a necessarily, those sort of things to me aren't part of your capital structure because they're part of the way that you're actually running the business. There's not aren't any choices. Lease is probably a more interesting one. Could you actually pay for the right of use up front? And therefore, is it sort of a voluntary issue?
Yeah, you could buy the asset.
You could buy the asset.
The philosophy of the standard is that we see it as fine.
Well, you could, but I guess if you think of right of use of the building, you only want it for 5 years. You could. So there are leases where you negotiate and pay up front, and so.
But where does that stop? I could issue shares instead of issuing debt. Uh-huh. I could sell an asset and use that cash instead of borrowing money.
I can
see the rehabilitation one and the pension. And
you can fund a pension plan.
Yeah.
You can pre-fund asset retirements.
You've got to think about settlement of it versus, you know, if you're talking about I could transfer my pension liability to somebody else, I mean, that's a different issue. So I think there are some, it is worth exploring. I think the management approach, I think if you go down this kind of path, trying to get it more prescriptive by saying, you know, we're going to ban things outside your control, it does really defeat the purpose of having it in the first place. And I wonder if you've already got enough tools around that within what's already in IS1 that was introduced around the requirements, if you've got another subtotal, plus what's in the pod around fair presentation. Together, that's enough for people to apply when they're coming up with, if they want to present that. And I don't think it should be a requirement that they have to present that on the face of the statement. But going further than that seems to be inconsistent with the idea of giving people that flexibility. And I think if you were to do it, people just reinvent it. You know, that'll be the our management views of a management defined, you know, I don't know what adjusted management performance it will kind of defeat the purpose, I think. And for that reason, didn't agree with what was proposed in 6F about being prescriptive about where you put that share of associates and JVs, because obviously it will depend on the business model in terms of whether it's integral or not. And in fact, it seemed to be trying to introduce a core versus non-core distinction in a quite a highly selective way, just because it's a required line item at the moment in IS1, and therefore you can see people are putting it in different places. If we had more prescribed line items, you'd probably get other items you could then pick on. And so I didn't think that was really not consistent with what we wanted to achieve. I think, just sort of seeing if there's anything else. Yeah, proposals around frequent versus infrequent and having requirements around that, I didn't think that was a particularly helpful way to go. And I think if you're focusing on what has predictive value, if I go back to the old project around reporting financial performance, that frequent versus infrequent was one of the factors that helps determine whether something has predictive value, but it's not limited to that. So if you've got changes in fair value of financial instruments or investment property or other fair value changes going through your performance statement, they are frequent. They're happening all the time, but they're not necessarily predictive if you're trying to get to some sort of sustainable effect. So again, it sort of seemed to be selectively picking on things, and I don't think that's necessarily the useful way to go. So. Now, probably the only last comment I want to make is when you're thinking about comparability versus flexibility, sometimes I think we confuse comparability in other words, requiring everybody to do it the same way, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's comparable. We go back to what the framework talks about comparability. We shouldn't be making unlike things look alike, and that's why I think trying to be prescriptive about things like share of joint ventures and associates is inconsistent with that idea, because it wouldn't be comparable. If you made people put it in a place that's actually not consistent with the way that they're running their business. Good luck.
Noble?
Thank you. We have three comments. First is that we think the performance measure that the ISB would prescribe to achieve comparability, it may not be appropriate for all entities, and therefore we think a compliant or explain approach should be adopted so that entities who believe that it is inappropriate for them to present the measure have the opportunity to do so. And with this compliant or explain approach in mind, we think that the ISB should not give up trying to define an operating profit type performance measure that applies to most but not necessarily all entities. That's our first comment. Our second comment is that regarding the management performance measure paper, it was unclear whether entities would be permitted or required to present those measures other than the cases where the entity provides such measures outside of the financial statements but within the annual report. That was unclear. And also it was unclear whether entities can present more than one management performance measure. Our third comment is regarding the income from equity method investments. And our understanding is that the nature of the equity method of accounting has been controversial and that the ISB has placed this issue in its research pipeline. And we do not think the ISB can or should determine the appropriate presentation without discussing the nature of the equity method of accounting. In our jurisdiction, most equity method investments are made in connection with the reporting entity's core business activities, and constituents think it is a faithful representation to present the results of those equity method investments within operating profit. So for us, everything would be above the line. Unless there's a specific reason that it is not part of the core business activities.
Patrick?
For us in France, it's a bit early stage because we're going to have it will be one of the themes of our outreach in September. Therefore, I express a personal reaction. I think in order to avoid being schizophrenic, we need to concentrate on this topic because we keep saying that the performance statement is key, and we keep saying also that we need to somehow be able to compare APMs. So I think we need to carry on working. It's not easy, but I think there is support from our side to the effort. Probably under the approach number three, principles approach, which I think is more appropriate. That being said, I think it is probably important to make a distinction between EBIT and MPM. On EBIT, I would consider that you have to be probably more prescriptive. Prescriptive approach is probably the most suitable. That being said, again, the business model, the dividing line for me is between capital structure and operations is the way the management. It doesn't mean that it can differ, but there are some elements that can be on one side or the other. Taking, for instance, some of the investments that are measured through the equity method, some consider it's good to have. They just see what they can do, but they can maybe arbitrate and say, okay, I'm going to sell because finally I cannot get where I want to be. Or, no, this is core for me, because this is one step in my strategy, I want to rule. So in this case, it would be core. So you have to leave a certain level of flexibility, but the core would be obvious. That's what I need to operate my business at a point in time with elements that are in between, and then you can say. But once this should be limited in my view. And it is the way you operate business today. It's not the way you could operate business tomorrow, because it has to be related to the statement of performance as it shows. If you operate via, I add something to my net profit, it has to come from real expenses or real profits in the statement performance statement. As regards, on the contrary, as regards MPM, I think it's going to be difficult to regulate apart from some high level principles, and therefore following a little bit what the stock exchange regulators have said, I would tend to recommend transparency and clarity and a full-fledged explanation on what are the components, maybe giving some ideas of what should be said and described in order to create clarity. So more prescriptive on EBIT, less prescriptive on MPM.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you.
When it comes to requiring EBIT in the income statement, we are concerned about comparability and operationality in practice. There is a view that EBIT could be presented in the income statement if consistent definitions agree. However, it should be optional, not mandatory. There is a more fundamental view that presentation of EBIT in the income statement is more useful for decision making of users when assets, liabilities, income, and expenses are presented by operating, investing, and financing activities. If not, its usefulness is very limited. EBIT would be one of us subtotals, and it is new notion for existing IFRS to introduce. Addressing EBIT presentation before structure of the income statement issue may be a piecemeal approach. This piecemeal approach may inevitably lead us to the idea that priority should be put on addressing the whole structure of financial statements, including the income statement, in terms of operating, financing, and investing with a holistic approach rather than piecemeal approach. And regarding management performance measure, without why specific requirements are necessary, only for management performance measure, because the staff recommendation is very similar to the current IS1 requirement subtotals. Some people preferred disclosing management performance measure in the notes to presenting it in the income statements. They thought presenting management performance measure leads to reduce comparability and add unnecessary complexity. Given the variety of non-IFRS performance measures, ISB defined that operating profit should be required in the income statements. And a management defined performance along with a clear reconciliation to ISB defined operating profit should be included in the final statements. Other people suggested that if the board decides to require the subtotals of management performance measure without the items outside of management control, the detailed guidance for those items should be provided to avoid the judgmental abuse for manipulative performance. And regarding a presentation of share of profit or loss of associates, without why presentation of fair value gains or losses of investments and the share of profit or loss of associates should be treated differently because characteristics of both are very similar. Some member suggested that the board's preliminary view to explore the possibility of creating and investing category in the income statement should also consider presenting the share of profit or loss of associates. And they thought that the two issues should be integrated to consistently address those issues. Thank you.
Alberto.
I have a stupid question, and I apologize for it. Coming back to a discussion we had before, if the board allows or prescribes the separate presentation of unusual or non-recurring items, where they should be, below EBIT, above EBIT, and the tax consequences should be separated from the income taxes generally, or should be included in the total of income taxes?
It wouldn't have any tax consequences.
Who knows?
Can have, they can be deductible.
The fact that it's infrequent doesn't mean that you don't pay taxes on that.
The suggestion in the board paper was that the unusual and infrequent items would be presented above EBIT, but below the management performance measure. Now, obviously, that was just a staff proposal in that paper. When we did talk about the adjusted EPS figure, one of the suggestions we had there was that you would provide information about the tax effects of those adjustments that you were making to the management performance figure, so that you would be able to see those tax type adjustments in there. But as Michelle said at the start, we didn't actually get on to discussing the management EPS figure in any detail at the board session.
Alexander?
Well, to cut two things here. One, I don't want to repeat Andreas and Jean, but a lot of people pointed to several operational problems to define EBIT, and interest can be accounted for in different ways, debt to equity. There are a lot of details, and that depend on the industry also. So some industries will have a given kind of peculiarity that's not the case in other industry. So this is against disclosing EBIT separately on the financial statement. That's the first point. So it's that more operational point of view. The second one is more conceptual. And here in page 17, you say that, well, one of the reasons here is to allow people to use EBIT as an input in discounted cash flow models. Well, a lot of questions about that. EBIT is a pool proxy for cash flow generating ability of companies in several sectors. For example, companies using the percentage of completion method in real estate business, so they can have EBIT for a long period of time without any single cash coming in. So I believe that step here, that which is from using EBIT into DCF, I think the step that we as a standard setter, et cetera, should not get involved with. If people want to use it, they should do that by themselves. They should not encourage it, or should not provide that information with that specific use. Because I personally have a question about that. But a lot of people mentioned specific cases when those two figures can go in different directions for a significant period of time. So EBIT and cash flow generating, and you have a cash flow generating information on the DCF. So which is. For me, is going the wrong direction. People want to use it; they let them use, but I don't think they should encourage that. Jim,
I just had a clarifying question. You talked about unusual items being below the management performance measure, but above EBITDA or EBIT. I'm sorry. I assume only to the, and it wasn't clear when I read the paper, but only to the extent that that's how management views performance. So it wouldn't require them. Yeah, okay. I was making sure it wouldn't require management to break out unusual items, but to the extent they do, that's where it would. Okay.
China.
So, the Chinese have
raised the comment as well about the number of judgments involved in the clarifications of income and expenses which relate to the capital structure, items which are outside management control and those which are around the between the boundary of frequently occurring and infrequently occurring. As a consequence, they see the statement of financial performance being divided into three parts, operating, financing and investing. However, there's a lack of clear guidance for the boundaries amongst the... I must put my reading glasses on next time I read this. Among the performance, operating and financing and the judgments, and they suggest that we consider these carefully. They generally support the proposal to require EBIT subtotal, but make the same comments around the definition of capital structure and the definition of financing expenses, which I think we've already made. They suggest that if the board do decide to require a subtotal of management performance measure to exclude items outside management control, there's a need for detailed guidance for those items. In terms of presentation of infrequently occurring items, they suggest that the judgment difference could be material in practice, and the circumstances of infrequency need to be considered. Regarding the location of the share of profit and loss of associates and joint ventures, they suggest it's better to consider the different circumstances of different entities to determine the location, but not absolutely locating under taxation for all entities. In some cases, the entity's main business includes the management of the investment of the associate and joint ventures. So I think that was what Patrick was saying.
Not badly done, this Chinese character, isn't
it? So I don't agree with Alessandro. I don't agree with Alessandro and many the other comments. Clearly, it's a challenge to identify what is financing and capital structure, but it is a very common and perfectly valid method of analysis by investors to think of a business profit and then think of how that business profit is shared amongst the various providers of capital. And it is fine as a starting point in DCF. Obviously, it isn't a cash flow, and it is the starting point, and then you're adjusting for the long-term contracting working capital items as well. And I think to dismiss it because it's a challenge in defining it, or dismiss it because, well, investors shouldn't be using it, I think is throwing it out too soon. I hope we carry on looking for a solution in this area, because the investors, when we did the outreach, were very supportive of trying to find some more comparable subtotals other than the very limited number that we have at the moment.
May I?
Of course.
I agree you should not stop using it because you cannot use it properly or define it properly. But I was not aware of that. But I've been showed some examples of companies using percentage of completion method that EBIT gets growing and cash flow gets down at the same time. So it's not that you're not giving a precise information, it is in the wrong direction. So if we as a standard setters to assume that, I'm not against the use of it, but I don't think that we should get involved in that, in the sense that justifying EBIT on the basis that's going to be used for that, because I don't know if anybody should use EBIT in that particular situation. It's hard to argue.
Well, in your DCF model, you have EBIT, and then you have deduction for exactly the circumstance that you're suggesting, and then you have the cash flow. So as long as you can model that deduction because of whatever's happening to those long-term contracts, then you're fine.
But that information is already there. So when you separate EBIT, you imply that this information is good for use as DCF.
What I've always found rather difficult when talking to investors is you go along and you know, we're setting all these standards, and they can't believe that we don't have a standard for operating profit. They say to me, what? I mean, you don't define it. We use it all the time. How can you not define operating profit? What's the point of all these standards?
Well, true.
One day.
It's a good guy. I don't know the answer, but I don't think that this EBIT is a solution to that question.
And what is interesting is that in our new insurance standard, which is basically, in practice, it's an industry standard, even though it's a standard for insurance contracts, that we have a fairly prescriptive income statement, which gives a huge amount of subtotal information, disaggregated information, to the investor. And so, of course, because it's an industry standard de facto, it's much easier to do so. There we are capable of doing it. It becomes more difficult if you try to do it on a general level, which is why we are also going to explore the design of templates for perhaps not prescriptive templates, but sector specific templates.
But then, I mean, that would only work as long as the industry is clean, so to say. You have a clean bank, you have a clean insurer. Mm. If you think about a conglomerate, if you think about a car manufacturer, they all do have leasing companies, insurance, banks, banks and the like.
I mean, we can complicate everything.
Yeah, and we're good at it.
Just to sort of support some of what Stephen said, and I very look forward to your comment letter when we publish something soon.
We look forward to writing it.
I think the reason why, I certainly agree with you, Alexandra, that sort of saying we like EBIT and we don't like this or whatever is not the business that we're in, but the reason why I think it is really instructive to look at what investors are using as inputs in their analysis is because it's so hard to come up with this definition of what is in EBIT. And by understanding better what it is they're trying to understand, which from what I understand is what Steve suggested, which is sort of what's coming from operations and then how do I finance it, it's giving us a framework to try and think about how we might come up with this articulation of what's in the I, and I agree I doesn't really capture it, but it's giving us a framework to think about. Because otherwise we get so caught up in, is it interest the way we define it? Is it all discounting? And at least gives us a way to think about it. And I think that's why we're talking about what investors use.
At the beginning of the paper, you mentioned that you're not talking about banks here, but I think it's our role here to give you guys a little bit of what's going to happen. Because most of conglomerates, most of people comment and they say, well, we are working on conglomerates. They have everything together. So EBIT doesn't work for financial firms. So how do integrate that? So I know that it's easier to concentrate on a retail kind of company, manufacturing, but
not sure that's easy either.
Yeah, it's easier than to look at insurance.
We could also do something that comes closer to what Andreas was suggesting, which is that we somehow succeed in defining EBIT or something similar to it, perhaps with another name, but which comes pretty close. Where we know it will not be perfect for everybody, that we in addition find more line items so that it is easy for everybody to just add and subtract, and will make it much easier for investors to play around with these numbers, in combination possibly with sector-specific templates, which might also lead to some spontaneous convergence of presentation in sectors. Tom?
Just a small clarification from Alessandro, just listening, is I think your concern was that EBIT is a bad proxy for cash flows.
Can be.
And that's a concern if people apply it that way.
Yes.
Okay, that's what I wanted to get at. I think
this is one of the concerns.
Yeah, and there may be others, but that, like, I would agree with you. If we create an EBIT or EBIT because we want people to make it a proxy for cash flow, I totally agree. So we need a conceptual basis that defines EBIT as being useful to users other than as a proxy for cash flow.
Correct.
Okay, that's it.
That's it.
Martin.
Only a short comment because, man, what I observe is in a lot of this discussion, we don't find a perfect solution. And if we don't find a perfect solution, many people think, okay, we should not go further and investigate and look in this kind of solution. But of course, I think we will not find a perfect solution, but we will find a better solution to the current situation, because as Steve said, many investors have said, okay, their starting point is a kind of operating EBIT kind, and then they do a lot of adjustments, and they find it very, very difficult to get this starting point. And I think if we can have a principle-based EBIT, the starting point will be better. It will not be perfect, but that is not what we should be looking for. We should look for a better solution than for a perfect solution. And we have that in many kind of things. When also I wanted to say that, because when the same is when we discuss dynamic risk management, is also that people giving us feedback and say, okay, they see problems, but they will not find a perfect solution, and therefore they think we should not do that. But I think we should look for a better solution, because it is always or often very difficult to find this perfect solution. But this does not mean for me that we should not look to improve this. And therefore, I think all this kind of solution, we maybe have some issues, but the question is, and that should be, I think, the driving thing, is it better than what we have?
We all know profit or loss is far from perfect. It's still there.
Well, don't kill the messenger. What you just said is like what peace and cure for cancer. Of course, everybody agrees with that. The point people are saying just this is not making things better than they're not attacking the concept, the idea. Just this is a specific solution.
Okay. So are there any other comments? Does the staff feel fortified by this discussion?
Just one question to you. Are you taking electronic reporting into account when discussing the format of the financial statements?
We are in regular discussions with our taxonomy team, yes.
It is in the back of our mind, because knowing that if we can go around in circles and not do anything, but the world around us is formatting like crazy.
Right. at the moment, in the taxonomy, it's an open bar, if I may say so, the definition of EBIT.
Yeah.
I mean, people put a tag on it, but they have to describe what's in it, I suspect. Mm. Can you confirm?
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, particularly with subtotals like EBIT and operating profit, they're not defined. So if they actually end up typing them as EBIT or operating profit, people take them and use them without actually examining what they comprise, then they could be very misled by the figures that are there.
Yeah, because the consequence is that if then you run a comparison based on electronic data, yeah. You compare apples and bananas.
I like that expression, open bar. It's generally a good thing.
Not in accounting.
Okay, any other comments? Okay, well, I think it was a very useful discussion. Not leading to simple answers. So unfortunately, because you would have put us to shame. But gave the staff more food for thought.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
So we can do
3:40. Yes.
Yep.
So 5-minute break. Yeah.
Yes, we have a 5-minute break, and then we're going to bring back the papers on IS 16. So it'll be agenda paper reference 4. If that's okay.
Yes.